good morning and you're very welcome to the show. And it's almost a relief to see a bit of good old-fashioned political argy-bargy on the front of the Sunday Independent. So the coalition TDs are all gearing up for fights over the budget. I think particularly Fianna Fáil and the Greens want the PUP put back up to previous rates or elements within it do. And so that's all going on, all jockeying around the budget and everything. Also, the stay and spend scheme. Wasn't that such a lovely, innocent idea from such an innocent time where we were all going to be staycationing through the winter and clicking our receipts and there you go. And so I think the general agreement that that might need to be looked at again, and a VAT cut is what's being suggested instead. They also have in the real world hospital brace for second COVID wave. So the Tallaght Hospital has closed its operating theatres and cut back on non-urgent surgeries. I'll tell you what, Leo Varadkar said something very interesting to Claire Byrne the other day. He said, so there's, what is there, 14,000 hospital beds in the system, and there was whatever that day, 100-ish people with COVID in the hospital. He said there's less than 1% of hospital beds are taken up with COVID. Yet, we seem to be approaching a situation this weekend where we are now talking about paralysing the whole health system again. And I know it can surge and it could go up to 2 or 3% or 4 or 5%, who knows, but you'd wonder, is there no way of hiving off the COVID into one or two hospitals or something and let the rest of it get on with it? Do we really, are we bringing it to its knees for what is at the moment 1% of the patients less than in hospitals? Business Post, budget VAT cut demanded as hotels predict winter crisis. And this is a stark reading for the hotel industry. Like, it's carnage. In November, 6% of rooms in Dublin County outside the city area are occupied, 7% in Cork City, 7% in Clare, 8% in Galway County, 17% in Galway City. There's a litany of figures here for the hotel industry, and none of them are good. They also have Pat Byrne from CityJet. Pat, of course, is in with us last week, and he's not for turning. Mainstream media, he's saying, are responsible for having broadly sensationalised the daily case numbers of COVID-19 and for making rock stars out of immunologists and epidemiologists. Who the hell are Neffet? He says there's no balance. We're relying on 4 or 5 people in Neffet and their desktop effing modelling. And they also have, yeah, hospitals at full capacity. They have Tallaght Hospital. They're also saying University Hospital Limerick has reduced scheduled elective care. So, like, these are all the knock-ons, you know. Sunday Times. So students' 24 million COVID payment is under threat. So this is like, should students, who remember a lot of it, there was that old story of, oh, my young fellow's collecting glasses for 2 nights and suddenly now he's on the COVID payment. But students who are going back to college now, or a lot of them are still getting the pandemic unemployment payment, and it seems to be quite tricky as to whether you would take it off them or not. It's costing 24 million a month. I suppose the student representatives making the point that the students missed out on all the part-time work and stuff they'd have over the summer as well. And, you know, a lot of people do work for the summer to pay their way through college. The Irish Mail on Sunday, state hasn't got power to shut meat factories. And they're also saying in that front page story, health chiefs have told the Mail on Sunday of fears of a winter of growing defiance as the impact of COVID-19 restrictions bite. And there is an air of defiance out there among some people. They have a poll today. We'll come back to it in a while. I'll just give you two little nuggets from it. At this stage now, should the Gardaí have the power to stop gatherings in homes that are in breach of public health guidelines? According to this Ireland Thinks poll, 70% of people say yes. So the old civil rights argument is diminishing all the time there in the face of obviously public anger over parties. Here's an interesting one. Do you think RTE should cease daily public updates on the latest COVID numbers? No, it's not just RTE doing it, but no, say 73%. Three quarters of the people want to see the numbers every day. They probably say, look, it's grim, but it's the only bit of it's the only bit of kind of hope or non-hope that we get in the day, maybe. The Irish Sunday Mirror, don't axe our Christmas bonus. Fears are growing the Christmas social welfare bonus will be axed. And if it is, at a time when there's money to burn for everything else, I think people will be very angry about that. The Sun on Sunday has a story about a woman who saw her best friend being murdered, and now she is she lives in terror because she is worried about the murderer getting out. And the Sunday World has, so Thomas Marr, the haulier who was sentenced the other day for drug trafficking, he was using his encrypted phone to plan a vicious prison attack on Ronan Hughes, the other haulier, who is the people trafficker. So there, that's the Sunday papers. Now, our panel today, Sinead O'Carroll is editor of the journal.ie. Pat McCann is chief executive of the Dalata Hotel Group, and he is weeping quietly to himself there after he read out the front of the Sunday Business the Business Post. And our third panelist, you won't have heard of him. He's a young man who's making quite a splash in a very obscure area of science and medicine called international health and tropical medicine. But I'm predicting you're going to hear a lot more from this guy in the next while, from the College of Surgeons, Professor Sam McConkey. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Morning.
Sam, you are saying to Maeve Sheehan in the Sunday Independent today that this is a different epidemic that we're seeing this time in terms of hospitalizations and in terms of deaths.
Yeah, so what we've seen over the last month or two was different from what we saw back in March, in that the age profile of the folk getting it now are mostly sort of 15 to 50, and only about 10% were over 65. And we know that it's the over 70s or older people who tend to have more hospitalizations. So the proportion that we're seeing now hospitalized is a lot smaller. I'd said about 70 out of the 3,500 folk.
But is it only a matter of time?
Unfortunately, we've been seeing all of those rising, the hospitalizations are rising, the numbers are rising, we can all see over the last 2 months. And unfortunately, as I said to the doctors on Wednesday, I don't feel, and everyone agreed more or less, you can't really keep the elderly and the young in our society separate, because we live with older people, we care for older people in nursing homes, their young people go in to look after older people. So it's very hard to this. In theory, it would be great if you could have two separate groups, the young and the old, but that's not the way our economy or society works, because we do interact with each other.
Okay, so I was wrong to take some hope out of that quote there. What you're saying is it's different at the moment, but that there is an inevitability to this.
Unfortunately, that's my belief, yeah.
I hear anecdotally that it's back in nursing homes. Do you hear that?
Again, I look at the data that we get every day from the Department of Health very carefully. And they are saying that there are six outbreaks in nursing homes over the last sort of three or 4 weeks. Now, we don't know the details of, was that two staff, was it residents, and or how big they were. So we don't have public knowledge of the details of the scale of those outbreaks. But that's what the publicly available data has told me. Now, that's much less than we had back in March and April, where there were huge, large, tragic outbreaks and a lot of sick people. So these may simply be just two staff, you know, who shared a cafeteria or something, for example, with each other that got it. So we're not seeing, I don't think, the large numbers of hospitalizations or deaths in nursing homes at this point that we saw in March, April.
At this point, okay. Just before I bring in the other panelists, I think the line that I heard the Taoiseach mention it, and the acting chief medical officer say this week, that there is a danger that other places go into lockdown, but that it is by no means inevitable. That seems to be the line on it at the moment. Do you have said, though, that this is the second wave? Is there an inevitability to what's going to happen here over the next few months, or do you think we could actually dodge the bullet here?
Yeah, I don't like the lockdown word because it's too binary, but I think legalistically sort of Garda imposed restrictions might not be needed if we as individuals and communities change our behaviour. We're now seeing a lot of local publicly elected representatives and local leaders saying, you know, in Donegal and Dublin, let's all change our behaviour here. And I think if the people in Cork, for example, where it's been rising, were to change their socialising for 2 weeks or 4 weeks voluntarily, as we've heard, you know, has happened in Sweden, that people have gone along to choose to protect the vulnerable by changing the behaviour, then you wouldn't need legislation and rigidly enforced heavy-handed restrictions, which may be what you're referring to, Brian, when you call it lockdown. But because it could be a voluntary, it could be a cooperative voluntary. And I think the voluntary would be better because none of us like restrictions. We resent being told what to do intrinsically. So I and we also get better cooperation if people voluntarily choose to do something. So I think that would be preferable.
Okay. Can I ask you one more question, seeing as you bring up Donegal? I think a lot of people were quite struck with Martin Coyne, the GP up there, who, and we were talking to him yesterday, and what he effectively said is that they did an informal contact tracing system. People almost contact traced themselves. And in a way, you'd wonder, he said, like, the dogs on the street knew where the parties were. They knew the terrain. They knew what had been going on, as against somebody ringing up from a contact tracing centre in Dublin. Is there a model there we could
I think there's adopt? So having local people doing local contact tracing might be much more effective than everything just on the phone. So I do think the power of local, particularly this was in one area of Donegal around Stranorlar and Lifford, whereas other parts of Donegal up around Mallon, there was almost nothing at all in terms of COVID, but it was one focal area where there's exceptionally high rates. And I don't know the details of what happened, but apparently he says that everyone there, it's common knowledge as to what events happened, and so essentially it was socialising and then large outbreaks in some of those social events. I think it was in people's houses, as far as I can
so understand. We could set up some kind of what kind of mechanism could you do in an area? Would there be people qualified in an area?
Yeah,
to
maybe
do this?
In local authorities, you have public health nurses, you have environmental health officers, you have public health and community health doctors, you have maybe administrative staff, data managers, secretarial support, and have three or four together in each local area that could do it locally.
Yeah, and of course there is something in one of the papers today about that, in the Business Post, Michael Brennan is saying that contact tracers are experiencing a lot of aggression on the phone. If there were local people that they knew and they trusted, that might not happen. Pat, the hotel situation, that looks like carnage there. What are your thoughts on it?
Obviously, it's pretty bad out there, and the way you look at it at this point in time looks pretty dire. However, I think it'll actually be a little bit better than that. Now, it'll all depend on where we have lockdowns. So, what happened, of course, since we had the Dublin lockdown. That affected the entire country because essentially most of the people who occupy the hotels and guest houses and B&Bs around the country are actually coming from Dublin. So that had an effect. And then, of course, we didn't have the counterbalance of that of people wanting to come into Dublin. So essentially you had a double whammy there that affected it. I think we need to be a little bit pragmatic.
Do you accept that we need to do this and that we are going to need to do it possibly for the next 6 months or a year? Do you accept that, or do you think there's another way?
I think one of the things we need to be careful about, if you look at the whole issue around COVID and what's happening now, we essentially have lost the audience. And part of the problem with that is that we have tried to impose. And when you look at what's happening, to my understanding, is if you look at the hospitality sector, there has been very few outbreaks since we reopened on the 29th of June. And if there is, I'm not aware of them.
Well, I think the outbreaks are not being traced back there, but there's a feeling
that's where they would be coming from. If there was outbreaks, then there would be a record of staff and things like that that would have been infected. And my understanding, like I know my 30-odd hotels, we've had very, very few incidents of either staff or customers. And mainly it's down to a controlled environment. And what we're actually doing is we're pushing people out of controlled environments into the home, because people will find an outlet. And it's like going back to prohibition in the US. When you try to restrict people, they'll find ways and means of actually doing something and relieving the pressure that they're under from a mental capacity or a social dialogue capacity in that sense. So what we need to be careful of, the unintended consequence of what we've done could actually be adding to the problem.
Sinead, what do you think of that?
There was something I was struck with Ronan Glynn said about 40 minutes into the midweek briefing this week, was that we shouldn't be focusing so much on what we can't do, but we should be focusing on what we can do while we're living with a brand new contagious virus that kills. And it really struck me that actually everything that we have been focusing on for the last, particularly probably since July, have been the individual things we can't do. Whereas if you compare what we're doing now to March or April, even in Dublin, people in Dublin are able to go out onto the streets, they're able to buy a takeaway coffee, they can sit outside, even if it's a little bit cold. There's a lot of things we can still do. We can book a night in a hotel. It's a controlled environment, as you said. There's a lot of things that we should be focusing on that we can do. It's not a government trying to impose lockdown on us for nefarious reasons. They're trying to manage a virus that is trying to replicate itself and kill people. So I think there is a change of emphasis that we do need.
Their sector feels they're being a bit picked on unfairly here.
I think the whole hospitality sector has taken the brunt of it, quite frankly. And it's all very well saying you can buy a takeaway coffee, but there's a lot of places who don't have that facility and can't do things like that, so are essentially closed. But I suppose in the broader sense, like the communication of what's happening has somehow drifted away. So typically you get word on a Friday night that something is happening, but you get very little detail, and it can be days or even weeks before you get clarity around what you need to do or can't do. So we're all kind of guessing outside the box as to what we should or shouldn't do.
And I agree with that. I think a lot of it is the communication or gaps. A lot of the time we do get the pertinent information 40 minutes into a press conference rather than at the start. I remember when we were told that GAA games had to go behind closed doors again. It was only maybe a day after that we found out that there was actually incidences of transmission between fans at games, whereas that wasn't what Micheál Martin led with that day. If the rationale is presented first, then you don't get the emotional reaction because you think, OK, that's fair enough. So the same with what we're talking about, the hospitality, we only found out a few days later when we were, it was actually Michelle Hennessy, a reporter from the Journal, asked, are you going to start tracing back to pubs and restaurants? And Ronan Glynn said, yes, we're going to start doing that now. We're going to ask if people were in restaurants or hotels or pubs. That's information we didn't have before. So all we could hear was, well, there's no transmission in restaurants or pubs, so why are we being told we can't sit inside them anymore?
Listen, speaking, Pat, of things being shut down very suddenly, there's a texter here to 51551 wondering what do the panel think about, there's a Donegal hotel offering rooms for €2 to get around the COVID regulations re-indoor dining. Now they say they're going to close up after the weekend, but they're saying they were left with a load of food that they had brought in for a hotel that was kind of fully booked for the weekend. They want to sell the food and they're doing this. So actually, let's ask an expert first. Sam,
I think it's fair to say it's not within the spirit of the law. Whether it's within the letter of the law depends, of course, for the lawyers to sort out, and I wouldn't be qualified. I will add that I was off a bit in August and I actually visited Downing. So it was one of the places I've been for the summer and enjoyed some.
Did you feel safe there?
Yeah. I did, yeah. Yeah, very, very much. The rural fan had rural in a show and then Skull and in the other side it was in as well, all felt very safe, and the hotels are very spaced out, and you know, it was a wonderful experience, I have to say. Okay. I really enjoyed it.
Pat, can you understand why they would feel they have to do this?
Like, absolutely. And this is what I'm saying, is that they're obviously not breaking the law, and they're doing something that they feel is right, and they will control it, and that's the reality of it. And hopefully there won't be any issues or outbreaks, which I doubt there will be. So to my mind, and coming back to sporting events, like one of the big problems that's happening now around the country at sporting events is that you have congregations outside the grounds because they can't get in. I was talking to one of the trainers of one of the Meath teams, and he was telling me that at the match that they're at, I won't mention it, but that during the match, they're all lined up standing on the tops of cars and jeeps outside the ground, peering across the wall. There is no social distance, there's no control. And that's it's the unintended consequence of not letting 200 or 300 people into the grounds in a controlled. Now, there has to be strict controls. If they're allowed in, they have to behave.
Yeah.
And we don't want things like it happened up in Tyrone last weekend at a match. So that doesn't help. But essentially, my mind is it's out in the open, it's in the air, and everybody says that if you're out in the open, in the air, you stand a very good chance of not picking it up. So I'm not sure that the things that we're doing are actually helping.
Okay, now, I put on your headphones there because there's a bit of tentative hope coming down the line here now, right? So there's an interesting story in the Sunday Times today, and the headline is Village to Get Weekly Virus Tests. And the person responsible for this testing is a man called Robert Quirk, and he's CEO of the Roku Group. Robert, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan. How are you?
Good. Tell us what you're doing.
Yeah, well, we had a tremendous day on Friday where we have introduced the latest of testing technology and made it available to the public here in Ireland under a pilot conditions. So we really believe that this is a tremendous step forward, putting everybody on the positive forward step for the first time since this pandemic hit. It means that people will be able to be tested with a nasal swab combined with a blood test for antibodies and have the results within 15 minutes.
Okay. So it was and how confident are we of this test?
Well, it's the test is currently getting people onto planes across Europe, and it's being used in Frankfurt Airport, Rome, in Düsseldorf, and has been rolled out by Lufthansa. So they've already performed a number of tests at the airport, which has enabled people to fly. So it looks extremely positive.
Okay, and where is the village where you're doing this?
It's in County Roscommon, and you know that particular project came around for one very special person. Look, Roscommon has a slightly aging population, but that said, there are still generations of people living under the same roof. You have vulnerable people who are afraid to leave the house, who are afraid to go down to their local stores, and really the technology and the systems exist today, which will actually help to reverse that. So what we want to do is create positivity in the village.
I have heard that there are antigen tests coming down the line and everything, but my understanding was that there was not one yet that had actually been kind of endorsed as being fairly foolproof. Sam, do you have any thoughts on antigen testing?
Yeah, I'm delighted to see Robert trying something new, but I think saying that the test has been used here and there isn't in any way confident that it actually works well. We've used bloodletting and leeches and lots of dodgy things through the years, and that doesn't mean they work well. So what we need to see is what's the false positive rate, what's the false negative rate, sensitivity, specificity. There are traditional ways of evaluating.
Can you tell Sam what the measures are there, Robert, on accuracy and stuff?
Yeah, so the test is being used, in over 60 countries around the world, but this is the first time it's being deployed into Ireland. It's the first rollout of that. So the test has been validated at 97% accuracy, which is very good. And it's a nasal swab test, which is inserted into an analyzer.
Okay. I mean, so the 97% is relatively good. For screening tests like this, you want high sensitivity, and it doesn't matter so much if the specificity is a bit lower. That's the first question. The second then, of course, is cost. Because if we were to test everyone in Ireland with the current PCR test, it's €125 a pop for 5 million people, would be €600 million to test everyone. So I think that's where the detail of cost and efficacy are the really two questions. And I think if it was
cost,
cheap,
Robert.
Yeah, so I agree with you. So this, whatever solution has to be put in place has to be, one, affordable, two, efficient, and three, available. So with rapid antigen testing, like we know we're directing supplies directly from the manufacturer, and we've also connected the HSE to the manufacturer. And antigen testing will be available for less than €20.
Yeah. So this approach could be really good at showing what areas are COVID-free and letting people in those areas be much more normal, and then maybe, unfortunately, restricting travel in and out of those areas because obviously you don't want it reintroduced. So it was done in a village in northern Italy near Bergamo by Antoni Crosetti about 3 or 4 months ago, and having that understanding of how in a local area it transmits at really thorough detail is very, very useful. So I think if we've effective and cheap tests, they're very, very valuable to us.
And do you think, Sam, that it would be something that companies could use? Could they have a reasonable amount of confidence in this if they were testing all their staff regularly like this?
Yes, yeah. And healthcare institutions and nursing home and doctor, having really rapid, accurate, cheap tests would really help us in all of this, yeah.
Like, Robert, it sounds like an absolute game changer. Like, and Sam, I'm kind of slightly surprised that Sam is not poo-pooing it, but he's clearly not. Why is there not more of this going on, do you reckon?
Well, look, we're pioneering a new ground here, Brendan. You know, we're all in this together, and we're trying to find solutions. But you know, it's up to people to try and drive forward, and trying to find effective models which are going to get us out of this hole. And you know, a lot of the time, you know, we would sit back and we would ask government to provide a solution. And what are we doing? And what's happening? But in reality, very often in cases of emergency, you know, the solution comes from innovation, and comes from industry, and comes from the academia. And that's where the solutions are being developed. And this is another example of that.
Okay, Robert, I'm not testing you out here, but I just do want to kind of make sure that we check out your bona fides for everybody and everything. Can you tell me a bit about the background to your company and what kind of stuff you do and everything?
Certainly. Yeah, the RockYou Group is an Irish company, but 99% of our operations are around the world. So we specialize in working with governments and ministers and presidents. All the projects we deliver are based around economic and social development. We would help communities to, you know, attract jobs or to increase tourism, you know, to help create jobs in the city by attracting companies or international foreign direct investment. And right now we're working with Canada and Niagara Falls about a project to help Niagara Falls become a center of excellence for renewable energy. And we're doing that through a number of local initiatives. So we specialize in working with governments and helping them. We tend to cherry pick 2 to 3 projects per year, which we really believe we can make a difference on. During COVID, we put a model in place to really meet this thing head on. We're in the third phase of that. Phase one was called Survive. Phase two was Protect. And phase three now is Thrive. So not only do we have to survive this pandemic, we also have to thrive. We need to build houses. We need to educate our children. We need to visit our loved ones. And we have to find viable solutions to do that.
Robert, are the HSE backing you up on this, or have you been involved with them?
Yes, 100%. So the HSE are monitoring the pilot and the rollout of this. There's no financial backing, so we've invested our own money to make this happen, to bring this technology to Ireland and to deliver a solution. And so there's no grants, there's no payments from the government. This is all a self-funded project. But their support is coming through, you know, supervising and monitoring the progress.
Okay, so they are in there. Sinead O'Carroll from the Journal wants to talk to you.
Yeah, I don't know actually if this is a question for Sam or Robert, and I'm loath to bring Phil Hogan up in this segment of optimism here, but during that whole debacle, we heard that when Phil Hogan travelled to Ireland, even he had a negative test, he was still meant to restrict his movements because there could have been some possibility that he was incubating COVID anyway. And in the same instance, if you have gone for a test, you still and get a negative test, you still have to isolate for 2 days because you have symptoms. So how does this rapid testing differ from the PCR test that means that you still have to self-isolate because you could be incubating the disease?
Well, at the moment, yes, absolutely 100% follow the national guidelines. So this is not about changing that. But what it is it complements it. So, for example, right now, people are not being tested. The only time you're getting tested is if you're symptomatic.
Or a contact.
Or you've travelled into the country.
But that's at your discretion. For example, like nurses in nursing homes, they're only being tested every 2 weeks now, and in some cases every 3 weeks. And that's just not good enough. So there's no screen before that, and we have to have solutions in place just to light up those dark corners, because we have to meet this thing head on. So we're not suggesting that this would, you know, in any way change the national guidelines, but it complements it and it evolves it. Remember, that solution was put in place back in March, at the beginning of the pandemic, and it hasn't moved one step forward since then.
Yeah, and look, I suppose, Robert, as the World Health Organization have been telling us from the start, we can't let perfect get in the way of something that might be useful. Sam wants to come in once more, Robert.
So I think to address Sinead's question, if you had a cheap available rapid test and you're able to do it every 5 or 6 days, then you detect the positive cases in the local community much quicker. Then they could isolate and their contacts could also be isolated and traced. So having really close check on who's got it in a regular way, which you could do if it's a cheap, accurate test, does really help us a lot.
So just to finish up on this, Sam, I suppose our focus has tended to be on that the vaccine will come and that will solve all our problems. Is the answer actually more likely to lie in this kind of thing, fast, rapid, mass, cheap testing?
This is certainly another way forward that would make our physical distancing more targeted, more nuanced. So instead of the whole country going into restrictions, only the people who've got COVID-19 antigen based on a test like this and their immediate contacts would have to restrict themselves, and the rest of us could sort of get on with our lives. So this would help us to keep the physical distance, but to focus it on the people who really need it rather than the whole country. The third way out is a small molecule like the HIV drugs or the Hep C drugs that have transformed some other diseases. So there are a number of ways out of this, not just a vaccine, and this is certainly one of them.
Look, Robert, I think we all certainly hope that you're onto something here. And would you keep in touch with us, will you, about as it goes on? I'd love to talk to you again about it.
Will do, Brendan, absolutely. Yeah. Look, this the pilot is going to run for a number of weeks. We've got several organisations involved, including schools, nursing homes, hospitals, where this is going to be stress tested and the proof of concept will be delivered. And then we're happy to share the results from that with you and keep you posted.
Okay, Robert Quirk from the Row Crew Group, thank you very much. Let's take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Sam McConkie, Pat McCann and Sinead O'Carroll. I'll tell you now what's coming in on text to 51551 and on email to Brendan at rte.ie is largely people talking about young people and compliance. They seem to be what's on people's minds today, and some people blaming the young people and other people saying we need to go easy on the young people, and people looking for, I think, a crackdown on compliance as well. Sinead, you were looking at, there's good stuff across the papers on this. Michael Brennan in the Business Post is writing about how solidarity is being tested by COVID fatigue at this stage. And Pete Lone is talking about it in the Sunday Indo as well. And the Sunday Times have the kids aren't all right. And I think the discussion here seems to be, A, is the ask of young people too much and is it unrealistic? And secondly, how do we talk to them?
There's two things there. So I think the first thing is a lot of our policymakers and a lot of how policy is drawn up and a lot of what we talk about on the media is from the perspective and viewpoint of married people. And even if they're married people with children or married people without children, there are people who have a household of more than one or a situation where they can handle something in a nuclear household where they are not the only person or they are with someone who they are in love with or have a familial love for. If you are a younger person, that changes that. So, and also the term young doesn't really mean anything anymore in Ireland. I don't know if we're talking about 15 to 50 year olds here or if we're talking about 15 to 25 year olds. But if you're looking at something and thinking, I don't know why all these young people have to meet each other, it's probably because you don't, like, you're fine at home. You are completely content and happy with being able to live your life within a much smaller confines. Younger people need a lot more than that. Their development needs a lot more than that. Second thing is this idea that we haven't been able to talk to them and get the message. We closed their schools down. They're not able to go to college normally. So whatever age group,
you think they're aware of it?
I think they're aware that there is a virus out there. I think they know. They're not stupid. Yeah, like, some of the things that are happening, they are being young people. There is some element of they know they're not at risk as much. And also they don't develop, their brains are not developed as much to take in the risks of passing it on to the more vulnerable. So
there's a mention today, I think it's in the piece in the Sunday Times, there's some academic whose name escapes me, I'm sorry, talking about how young people are inherently narcissistic, which I thought was a kind of a mean way of putting it, but I suppose there's an element to that.
Yeah, and there's decades and decades of psychological research to show that. And like we all did things when we were in our early 20s that we would absolutely not do now because they seem ridiculously risky and stupid, and why would we have put ourselves into those situations? Even I was saying to my friend yesterday, the idea of drinking a naggin of vodka now, like, would send all of us at this table, like, into a head spin. Whereas that was completely normal behaviour when I was 20 years old. I wouldn't have thought twice about it. I would have thought twice about it the next day.
So, Sam, there's an interesting point made in, I think it's in Michael Brennan's piece, and it's Michael McNamara, who's the head of the COVID group. He read this piece in The Atlantic magazine, which I was very impressed by, I have to say, from the get-go. But it was about the AIDS epidemic. And basically, the point being, which I think Michael McNamara has made this point, that preaching abstinence will get you nowhere. That what you have to do is get people in a realistic way to modify their behaviour. Yeah. Are we asking too much of young people if we expect them to act like the rest of us?
I think we are. I think we have to look, as I said in this program about 4 or 5 weeks ago, that we've got to look at the offering to our younger generation in the round, in the whole, and they're worried about career, about jobs, about housing. So this is back to the how much does it cost for young people to get housing, whether they're working or in college? And maybe we need some sort of public offering, like, say, a one-bedroom apartment within 3 miles of everywhere you can get for maybe 300 or 400 a month, whereas we all know some students are paying maybe 800 or 1,000, and that worries our youth. They're going off to Berlin because they cannot get affordable housing.
That's
here.
That's the broader issue, which we will come back to if the pandemic ever ends. But in the immediate term, we're coming into winter now and we need people to behave in a certain way. And there does seem to be a certain amount of evidence that that's unrealistic for young people and unfair on them, maybe, as Sinead says. Is there a different ask we could make of them?
I suppose my view is not to target one segment or another, not to be targeting, you know, migrants or Chinese or people from Korea or outsiders or young or old or employers or unions or sports people. I think we have to see that we're one community. It's young people have their own needs, as we've just heard Sinead very well say, but it is often about things like making friends, about getting to know people's social circle. How am I validated? How do I develop? How do I, from the friends I have. And, you know, it's a laugh. Of course, we were all telling them not to be on their computers and phones so much a year ago. And now we're saying, no, you be on your computers and phones. You know, and some are fine with that, but others actually want to meet and socialise. I think the challenge is to do it in smaller groups. So it's finding bubbles of young people that choose 3 or 4 friends and hang out with those.
Okay. I think that's the thing. We need to give them
so
options.
Here's a specific thing we could say to young people. Isn't that great? Like, if we just told them gave them one simple thing and said, look, bubble up.
And going back to what Pat said as well, like controlled environments. So if you say to people, yes, you can meet in small groups and there will be controlled environments in which you can do that, be it if they play sport together, be it going to a pub, be it going to dinner or whatever it is. And I think it's really important to say as well, there's actually very little evidence that young people aren't being as compliant as older people. Like Professor Lunn is saying that in the Sunday Independent today. He said, if you look at the data, it's true that young people are complying only somewhat less. There's little evidence of outright rejection. And I think a lot of the anecdotal things people are saying and seeing is a lot of stuff taking place outside as well, which is going back to there is less risk there.
I think there's a danger in all of this that you kind of put young people in a box and you say, well, they're the problem. When if we fix that, we have everything fixed. And in reality, we don't. The reality is that this is a much broader issue. And when you look at where, I suppose, infections are occurring, it's not really around young people. It's around essentially the family home and what's happening in that. And I suppose
that's where we're seeing them. That's where they're presenting because of the nature of our contact tracing at the moment.
Like, correct.
I think they are getting it out in the community. And they are getting it in.
Well, they have to get it somewhere.
In pubs and restaurants and hotels.
I think. Like my worry is that in the overall context of where we are now on COVID and trying to control the spread of it is that essentially we have lost a large part of the population around compliance. And I suppose it comes back to something that Danny McCoy and IBEC has been talking a lot about is the need for social dialogue.
We should say you were the president of IBEC.
I was the president up until last Thursday.
Present your conflicts.
So I will absolutely, and no problem, and I'm still involved with them. But like he talked about the need for social dialogue. Now, this was long before COVID. And one of the things we always talked about was things like housing and health and key issues that are happening in Ireland today. And what we need is to have a broad brush of conversation going on. And this has to be set up by government to have this social dialogue. So it's the business community, it's the employees' organisations, it's student bodies, it's all of these together meeting on a regular basis and coming up with a consensus as to how we can live in our new Ireland. And of course, COVID has brought this really home that we don't have this platform. And I think this would be a great way for us as a general populist to get messages out there.
Okay, a form of a citizens' assembly.
Well,
of
it's actually real representative bodies.
Okay,
as opposed to kind of people picked out of the blue kind of. And I think it would be a great way of getting messages and a consensus around message, because of course this is the other problem we all have, is that there's not a consensus even among the medical people around the messaging. So just be careful about picking young people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think we were here. What we were saying is that maybe they need to be cut a little bit more slack than other people. Now, on the compliance issue, put on your headphones, guys, please. And Monaghan GP Ilona Duffy is on the line. Ilona, good morning.
Morning, Brendan.
Now, on the compliance issue. So, and this is not just about people gathering in parks or whatever. This is at the... at the hard edge of it. You say your experience is that a lot of patients are not self-isolating when they should be. How do you know this?
Well, number one, we know this from ringing actually people with test results just to make sure that they know they are positive. And I suppose one case this week that stood out for me was a case of a person who was close contact of a positive case and would have been advised that as a close contact and they had to isolate, and unfortunately did have a test. And when I rang just to confirm they're aware that their test was positive, realised that was told by another family member, actually, they're not here, they're out. So that, and again, talking to other people, I've had two people who've been exposed this week to the virus, again, by people who were close contacts of positive cases. And it just proves this whole necessity for people to stay at home when they are the close contacts. And I think really it's that lack of understanding and not getting that message that is,
and
is
why
the problem.
Isn't the message getting through?
Well, I think there's a lot of mixed messages may be coming from us all, in that, you know, on one hand we're saying this is awful, this disease can kill, so we have a cohort of patients who are at risk, like the more elderly members of our community and those with underlying illnesses, who are really anxious or afraid to leave their homes. Then we have the other group, the younger group, and when I say younger, I'm not necessarily meaning young teenagers, etc. I mean just those who aren't at risk, who are hearing the message that actually most people who get this disease will get it in a mild form. If you meet it, there's 1 in 10 chance of you becoming infected. So they're kind of, it's being downplayed in their mind. So when they get a message that you're a close contact of a positive case, they feel fine. They think, well, if I feel okay, sure, it's all right. If I start to get symptoms, I'll stay home. And what they fail to understand is that there is a period of time before anybody gets symptoms that they will be shedding that virus. Therefore, they will be passing on the infection to others, and they won't know that. And also, we know that there are those people who have the virus in their system and are shedding it and have no symptoms at any stage. So what we're trying to do is get these people to stay at home and so that they're not unknowingly spreading it. But the message is not getting out there.
And just so this came up on the show yesterday, and can we just clarify it again, Ilona? Because I think a lot of people were kind of slightly surprised by it, which is that if you're a close contact, even if you get a negative test, you self-isolate for 14 days anyway, yes?
Absolutely. And I think one of the issues is that people are panicking, wanting to get this test. They get the text saying you're a close contact, or they get a phone call from a friend or a colleague, and they kind of feel, well, if I get the test, I'm going to be clear, and I want the test fast, and I want to get it done. So, you know, it takes a long time to explain, and I think that's where you talked about the contact tracers getting a bit of abuse. I think this is the thing, because people are saying, what, you can't expect me to be out of my life for 2 weeks. I can't not go in for 2 weeks. I can't not go to college. I can't not circulate. And they really, people get into a bit of a panic. So they then feel that if they have a test and it's negative, they can go back. But the message is clear. From that moment when we feel that you may have come in contact with the virus, you've been in close contact with somebody who's tested positive, there is a potential for you to start shedding that virus over the next 14 days. So it won't happen immediately. There may be a few days of a lull, and that's during that time that we will be contacting you and the public health teams will be contacting
you. And Ilona, just finally and briefly, you're saying we should introduce fines.
Well, I think I threw that out there as kind of a sense of frustration during the week, especially having talked to two of my patients who were really distraught at the fact that both were vulnerable, both now feel that they've been exposed to this virus when it could have been prevented. And we have to take personal responsibility for our actions. And if you're told that you pose potential risk, that you may have this virus, you have to stay home. And if you're not willing to do that, we have to look at public health measures as are in place for other infectious diseases and perhaps enforce that and introduce some kind of
penalty. Okay, thanks, Ilona. Sam, do we need to get hardcore here on people? Like we've been advising and encouraging and everything else. Do people need to see fines?
Well, I would encourage the efforts of people like Ilona and the GP in Stranorlar, who are using their contacts of, you know, several thousand people to take a local lead to try and persuade people to do the right thing. I think that's the best way and the most likely way to get widespread community buy-in.
You're against enforcement.
If you start fining people, then people react against you. Sometimes the reaction is a stronger force in the opposite direction than actually the action doing fines. For example, we have fines for people who, you know, don't isolate for 14 days after coming to country, but they haven't really been enforced in any way, shape, or form. I think it's 6 months in Mountjoy or up to €2,500 fine, but I don't believe anyone has been brought to court for that.
Okay, I thought it was the filling out of the form was where broke the laws against the self-isolating.
That is right, but if people didn't stay at the place they were in when they filled out the form, then they've lied on the form.
Sure, as if we know where any of those people are, let's face it. Yeah, all right, let's take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
God almighty, I'll tell you, people are so desperate for any bit of hope. Like the texts flooding in about, oh my God, we hope that Roscommon project works, and you know, and people saying, look, it'll have to be verified, and I think people would like to know more about all of it. We did as much as we could there in terms of establishing the bona fides of it, but it just shows people are starving for any bit of light at the end of the tunnel here. Sam McConkie, Pat McCann and Sinead Carroll still with me. I know, as we were observing at the beginning there at the front of the Sunday Independent, politics is happening, is still happening, and trying to inch its way back to the front pages as well. Sinead, we've had a few polls in the last couple of weeks. The Mail on Sunday have an Ireland Thinks opinion poll today. What's the state of things according to that?
Yeah, and some people of a Fianna Fáil persuasion should probably savour the next few words that I'm going to say, because it doesn't happen often, or hasn't happened often in the last few months, that Fianna Fáil are up in this Ireland Thinks poll by 3 points. And they're on 14%. Obviously, that's not a number they want to hear. But
so roughly halfway between where they were in the last two polls. I think they were like, they were 20 or something, or 19 or 20 in the Sunday Times was last week, and they were 10 in the Business Post the week before.
Somewhere, but it being up on the last Ireland Thinks poll, I think, is probably the trend they're looking on rather than comparing
that's
polls.
That's certainly what they look at, yeah.
And Fine Gael and Sinn Féin have shown a drop of support, 3 percentage points for Fine Gael and 2 for Sinn Féin, so on 32% and 28%.
So probably not widely outside margins.
Exactly, nothing to talk about. The sample size of the poll is 1,200 people. It was taken yesterday between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. It uses random sampling from face-to-face poll along with SMS polling. So
it was only done yesterday.
So you're talking people are, you know, haven't got used to the Dublin measures, the Donegal measures were in. So you're seeing probably that boost of Fianna Fáil. Micheál Martin had performed better during the week in terms of communication.
The more lockdowns he does, the better it could be here.
Well, we have always known that it was an easier communication project what Simon Harris and Leo Varadkar had to do back in March and April than trying to reopen slowly. It's always much more difficult.
So they'd be hoping for the rally round the flag that they missed out on.
And you mentioned the other ones, like about Gardaí getting more powers and RTÉ continuing with the daily COVID update. So I think that also probably gives us a little bit of perspective of what people are feeling, and probably they would probably agree with the GP there that there should be fines. The idea that people actually do want more measures in place to, I guess, punish people who are breaking the rules or seem to be not doing all they can. I would agree with Sam. I'm not sure that's the best way to go. I think the idea of Gardaí coming in and breaking up communions might not actually be what people think that they're responding to there when they say they would like Gardaí to break up parties.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I guess the kind of political energy of the weekend, the drama certainly, was around the appointment of, it was 8-10 more special advisors, Sinead, on the same day that the pandemic unemployment payment was being cut. Pat Lucinda Creighton is writing about it today, and she's saying ministers are not superhuman. They need expert advice. They're busy people. They're trying to innovate, and we need these experts.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we need to be careful about how we deal with this, because while they do need expert advice, I think the timing of the announcement is what everybody was actually jumping on, that it was done the same day as the pandemic employment level went down. So essentially, for people, I don't think were questioning the appointment. They were questioning more the timing of the announcement. Now, you would ask yourself the question, do they need all of these advisors? And if they do, they do. But I think that's where people are beginning to question as well. Do they need all these advisors? Particularly when we have a very good, public service who are a lot of experts in these spaces as well. So essentially, there's a debate to be had about this.
Yeah. I'd actually love to know the Venn diagram of people who think, like Lucinda, that it's actually value for money to have these special advisors on 67 to 78,000 euro, but still want to take any kind of PUP payment off students who have been in the working environment over the last couple of years see what kind of money they're okay with spending.
She makes a point that if the whole thing was made more transparency, that people might buy in more. If the government, instead of kind of scuttling away from it, if they said, well, no, actually, this is who these people are and this is what they're going to do, and that maybe you have a Dáil committee who vets them and we can see where the money's being spent.
Pat's correct. It's an absolute timing issue. But it's also, there's a paragraph in Lucinda's piece where she says, in truth, special advisors should be, she said, doesn't say they are, she said special advisors should be policy experts in the particular fields for which the minister holds responsibility. Oftentimes, the minister will have chosen a special advisor who is already on their staff before they even know what junior ministry they would have gotten. So those two things don't match up all the time. So again, going back to the transparency, if these were people who we did know were going to make the policy decisions of junior ministers better, well, then you might say, well, there might be value and money in that. But junior ministers are meant to be there to help the minister. The minister also has his number of special advisors or her special advisors. So then these junior ministers also have a number of special advisors. So you can see why people are a little bit cynical about it.
Yeah. And actually, Catherine Martin appears to have been giving out about it at Cabinet, when you would imagine there is a woman with about 10 areas under her. Correct. And they're the exact 10 areas that are being hit hardest by COVID. I'd say she needs a bit of
she
expert advice
the smartest
at the moment.
Political manoeuvre this week in terms of timing, that Hugh O'Connell got that source material on the front page of the Sunday Independent today.
Okay, we've 2 minutes left. Sinead, take us to Thailand. This is a story from the Journal, and I noticed it was one of the most read stories on the Journal. Tell us about this.
So we think our defamation, well, we know our defamation rules are terrible in Ireland, but in Thailand, an American is threatened with jail over a negative TripAdvisor review. So he went to the Sea View Resort Island, Wesley Barnes did, and he complained on TripAdvisor, and then the owner of the resort filed a complaint about it, and now he is facing up to 2 years in jail.
Now, in fairness, he seems to have kept putting up different reviews on different sites. He accused them of modern slavery.
Yeah, so,
and stuff like that. And they did say they tried to contact him before they went to the
And the site did remove it for violating its guidelines, because obviously it's a hard thing to prove modern day slavery was actually happening in the Thailand hotel. But
Pat, is TripAdvisor the bane of your life as a hotelier?
Not at all, actually. And I think people, like, we've been living with TripAdvisor for a long number of years, so we're well used to what actually happens on TripAdvisor. And typically what happens is you get the extremes of it. So you get the extremely happy or the extremely peed off, essentially.
Yeah. And so it's either Miguel was an amazing waiter and Johnny in the bar was fantastic and we loved this and that, or else this is the worst place I ever stayed.
And what has actually happened as well over the years is that customers have become very adept at understanding what's going on, so they can decide. And really,
What you're saying in a nice way is they know who the mad people are.
Correct.
Right? Yeah.
And it all depends on the response as well. So if the hotel or restaurant or bar responds well, that gets a very positive.
Sometimes
no matter what
you see some guy in broken English in some hotel down the med gets into a fight with the person reviewing, and you're like, don't do it.
One of my favourite things to do is when you have a really nice experience in a hotel, then going on TripAdvisor to look at the 1-star reviews so you can see what nitpicking people do at amazing experiences that they've obviously had.
Absolutely. Okay, listen, Sinead O'Carroll, Pat McCann and Sam McConkie, thank you very much. And stick with us. Michael Harding is coming up after the news, but now, just coming up to noon, we'll go to the newsroom and Kate Egan.